The information you are about to receive may one day save your life. Our guest for this broadcast, Roger Perino, has had a storied, decorated, and illustrious career in the Marine Corps, law enforcement, national security, and homeland security. His accomplishments are almost too numerous to list in this time frame, but I will try. Son of a New York City police officer, Roger first joined the Marine Corps and then became a New York City police officer himself, where he was, among other things, a narcotics detective, a hostage negotiator, and the commanding officer of Manhattan North and South Homicide. For his heroic actions at the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, Roger was awarded the Medal of Valor by the mayor of the city of New York. Several years later, Roger Perino was the chief detective that reinvestigated the infamous Central Park jogger case, resulting in the vacatur of the convictions in that case. Roger Perino retired from the NYPD and then became a law enforcement advisor to the Marine Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he saw combat. In 2014, Roger Perino came to work for me in Washington as senior advisor to the Secretary of Homeland Security. In 2017, then Governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, contacted me and asked me for recommendations of three names for the position of New York State Commissioner of Homeland Security. I gave him three names: Roger Perino, Roger Perino, and Roger Perino. Roger served in that role for a year and 10 months. On top of it all, Roger Perino has been, over the last 35 years, one of my best friends on earth. Roger is a disciple and proponent of the doctrine run, hide, fight. In the wake of the recent shooting at 345 Park Avenue, I've asked Roger to share a few moments with us to explain what that means. This will be a little graphic and disturbing, but I think it's important for you to hear it. Roger Perino, welcome to WBGO, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. How are you?
All right. Roger, run, hide, fight. What does that mean?
So run, hide, fight, It does mean when it's just like what it sounds, but it's really based on what we grew up in on stop, drop, and roll. If you were on fire, three things that you have to do to survive the fact that you're on fire. You need to stop, you need to drop, and you need to roll around on the ground until you put the fire out. So based on that, the federal government got together during the Obama administration and got active federal and local law enforcement together and some retirees together to come up with something so that individuals can try to survive an active shooter before law enforcement shows up. And that's the key to this. The key is, this is what an individual can do, not what an institution can do, not what the government can do for you. It's what you can do for yourself. And perhaps if you're responsible for someone like a child or a spouse, what you could do to increase your chances of surviving before the authorities show up.
Right, right. So run, the run component of this, what does that mean?
So run, so you have run, hide, fight. So what does run mean? And I need to stress this, because when this was first developed, they thought run was the first choice. It's not the first choice. Any one of these three can be your first choice. But run is basically build a distance between you and the assailant. So if it's a gun, you need much more distance than if it's a knife or if it's a baseball bat. But the bottom line is create a distance between you and the attacker. That's what run means. So can you run? Yes. Critics of run, hide, fight say, well, this doesn't work for the handicap. That's not true. If you're in a wheelchair, that means roll. That means if you can't walk, that means crawl. It means just create a distance. However that you can do that, that's what you need to do.
Number two, hide. What does that mean?
Hide is, you would say, cover or concealment. It means just what it says. But the bottom line is there's two types of hiding. There's one out of view, and then there's one where you cannot, you can be seen, but perhaps cannot be touched, meaning behind bulletproof glass. Now, very few of us have bulletproof glass that we can hide behind. But you can legitimately hide behind a cardboard box. But if you're seen, it's not going to prevent a bullet or even a knife from going through a cardboard box. So what you want to do is you want to get into a situation, possibly where you barricade yourself and you hide. Now, here's the don't hide. You don't go underneath your desk unless you've already barricaded a door. If you're in a theater, you don't go to the floor and duck your head.
Why not?
There's numerous accounts where I'm going to go off on a little bit. I find the studies will show that these shooters are not warriors. They're not gunfighters. They're not looking for a battle. What they're looking to do is they're looking to harm and cause pain to people who are defenseless. They're looking for the easiest person to shoot. So there's many stories of the movie theater shootings in more than one occasion where people just ducked behind their seat and the shooter comes up and sticks a bullet behind their head, the gun behind their head, and pulls the trigger.
Right.
So I don't want you hiding or ducking when there's still ability to get to you. So you try to hide when you could put up a barrier, a locked door, a closed door, a door that has a chair underneath it. That would be hiding. And you can run, then hide, then run again. Or you can hide, then run. You just continue to do whatever it takes for that 7 to 9 minutes before law enforcement shows up.
I read an article about a cleaning worker at 345 Park who hid herself in a closet, and she could hear the shooter right outside the closet. She could hear the bullets flying by right outside the closet. And though the closet was not locked, it seemed apparent to me that the shooter was just looking for an easy target rather than look behind closed doors and so forth. So hiding may actually mean hiding in a very simple unlocked place, right?
Yes, but if you have the ability to lock it, or you have the ability to jam the bottom door, it makes it even safer. So when this was first start, they used to tell you not to go into a closet. Right. They used to tell you not to lock yourself into a place that you can't escape. But time and time again, and I was with you on one of the biggest ones, was the Orlando shooting in the bar.
Yes.
And many people survived by going into the men's bathroom and closing the door. And they survived. And there was no reason, there was no way to escape if that shooter gained entry into that bathroom. But again, if you're part of an active shooter and you survived, you did the right thing. So we have to adjust our thinking and studies that if that's the only choice, it may work. To add your chances of survival is to somehow jam that door, make it difficult. The slightest bit of difficulty, turning the knob. Maybe you've jammed a shoe underneath the door so he can't push it forward. The shooter will, under many circumstances, just go look for an easier target.
Last but not least, what does fight mean? You don't have a weapon, obviously. What does fight mean?
So I disagree with you, sir. It's not obvious. You have a weapon everywhere. I can look in your room behind you. There's loads of weapons behind you. I see a picture frame, I think. That glass on the picture frame can be used to cut and slash. You have your shoes. You have a T-shirt that you can wrap around a throat. You can pick up the chair that you're sitting on. You use anything that's available, anything that's within reach of you. My favorite is a fire extinguisher.
Well, what good is all of this against an assault weapon, though?
So I don't like the fact that you use an assault weapon because it could have been any kind of weapon and it could be a firearm. The bottom line is that you get the jump on them and perhaps they're not able to bring it up and take that aim. Perhaps you're getting them as they're transitioning from one room to another. Perhaps you're hiding behind a door. Perhaps you're hiding behind a desk, and then you just jump up and wail him when he or she doesn't have that firearm pointed at you. But the bottom line is, fight is not a decision you make. It's a decision made for you because you can't run and you can't hide. And then you attack with full force with whatever you have, and you don't have to subdue the shooter. All you have to do is stun them or delay them so that you can again, start your run, hide, fight.
Right, right. What you're really saying is, by fight, is make it hard for the shooter to come at you and delay him in some way, right?
So, sir, I think make it hard for the shooter and delay him in some way is absolutely apropos for any one of the three. That's what you're doing when you're running. You're making it difficult. That's what you're doing when you're hiding. And that's when you're doing your fighting. But fighting is not a, like when I first started teaching this, and unfortunately I picked it up more in the younger crowd and sometimes with people, they would decide that they would listen to my presentation and say, oh, I'm a runner, or oh, I'm a hider. And unfortunately, you can't look at it that way. You have to keep all three options open. I understand if you feel as though you absolutely can't fight, then maybe you perhaps you need to concentrate on your running and hiding. But I would tell you that like a 90-year-old senior citizen in a wheelchair could possibly fight, unfortunately not to save themselves, but by ramming into a shooter in a wheelchair and hugging a leg or hunting could delay him and distract him enough where other people can survive. But the bottom line is you're fighting because your only other option is going to be death.
Right.
Or you would try to increase your odds by fighting.
So I heard you say something very interesting on TV the other day on this topic, which is that most active shooters, if not all active shooters, have no exit plan. They have no exit. Unlike an assassin, they have no exit plan. It's an act of suicide or death by cop. You've been a hostage negotiator. So explain the mindset of an active shooter.
So I've never negotiated with an active shooter. But the mind, what we believe to be the mindset of the active shooter is that they're so obsessed with some sort of situation, for example, concussions. By the way, he diagnoses himself that you know, he can only be diagnosed after a medical examination. So the guy's a little perhaps not mentally stable. But the bottom line is he decided the NFL was responsible for him having concussions, which then was responsible for his pain. They have an unreasonable obsession with why they're picking out their targets.
Like a hate crime.
So here's the deal. Your survival. Do not get obsessed with the motive of the shooter. Doesn't matter whether they're a white supremacist, doesn't matter whether they're anti-Semitic, doesn't matter whether they're an extremist of some religion. Your survival tactics are all the same.
Sure.
So, right. And I'm gonna try to make a little bit of a joke here, but let's say the shooter's a white extremist, and I'm a white male. I'm gonna say, well, I'm good. I don't have to run, hide, fight. He's going to pass me up and go after somebody of color. That's not how we approach this. Or it's this shooter's anti-Semitic. Well, I'm not Jewish or from the Middle East, so it's not going to be a problem for me. No, that's not it. The tactics to survive have nothing to do with the motive, and you don't get wrapped up in motive if you're really trying to concentrate on how you might want to plan to survive. Back to your original question was, though, the shooters have shown a propensity for planning. They have shown a propensity for picking their targets. But they have not, on a very, very high amount of cases, shown any escape plans or any plan Bs after the shooting, which leads me to believe that this is the last thing they're looking to do.
What's the first objective of law enforcement when they arrive on the scene, an active shooter situation?
Well, this is a very good point because I retired from the NYPD in 2003. And by the time I get involved with studying mass shootings and active shootings, the tactics of law enforcement changed. So if you can refer to my time in law enforcement as the old days, in the old days, it was contain the shooter. And now that has changed to the first law enforcement officers on the scene are to find the shooter and try to fix and terminate him.
Right. Right. Even before hostage rescue.
Oh, way before hostage rescue.
Right.
Yeah. So what used to be is that, you know, your patrol officer would secure the area and then you'd call in, like, so for lack of a better term, what the public would refer to as the SWAT team, or in the NYPD, they refer to emergency service. But now that whole paradigm has changed in law enforcement, that whoever the first officer's on the scene is, he's got to go and locate and try to stop the shooter.
Whether he's a specially trained sharpshooter or the cop on the street, right?
Yes, that's correct. But what's important for your audience is that first cop on the scene is not there to give you first aid. He's got to go. He's got to pass you. He's got to ignore you and try to find the shooter. And by the way, when he first shows up, he doesn't know if you're the shooter or not. So you have to be very careful on how you communicate and the actions you take while this cop is showing up, because he knows that he might not survive the day.
Right.
And he thinks everybody's a potential threat to him. And unfortunately, he's now been trained not to give you first aid, but to go and get that shooter. And you have to make sure that you're showing your hands. Don't go run at him. Don't go or him or her. Don't go hugging him. Stop the bleeding for yourself or for the person next to you. And if you have information that will help that police officer or that law enforcement person, give that information as quickly and as clear as possible.
I've heard criticism that in the case of 345 Park, the shooter was able to park his car on Park Avenue, get out of the car with an assault weapon, brandishing assault weapon, walk the several yards into the building and start shooting before anybody from the police got there. My assumption is that that's an unreasonable expectation. Cops just simply don't respond that fast. They can't. They can't be everywhere, right?
Yeah. And quite frankly, you know, Midtown Manhattan probably has one of the quickest response rates in the country. Can you imagine if this happened in the countryside in Alaska or Montana, where it takes an hour and a half for a police to respond? But here's the situation. Like, how many people saw that? How many people didn't realize what they saw? How many people saw it and convinced themselves that it was an okay scene, that it probably wasn't going to be bad, right? Our human nature has trained us to survive by looking at things and not looking at them as being bad, always finding a good reason for why it's happening. So how hard would it have taken for one person to see the direction he's walking into and go run into the security guards and tell them to lock the doors? So easy for me to say because I live this world. But the bottom line is people have to be more observant of their situation. They have to be more aware of their surroundings. Get on any train. I know you take the train to Manhattan. Get on any subway. Get on the path. Get on any bus. How many people are looking up, looking around, seeing who's on the bus, seeing who might be a threat, who might not be a threat? Nobody's doing it. They're all in their phones. Nobody's aware of what's going on.
Right.
I don't know this for a fact, but I think if we had the ability to zoom out of the videos that were of this guy walking, you would see everybody's looking down into their phones or talking into their phones and not paying attention to what's going on around them.
Yeah. And the New York City subway, you stop and you look at what everybody in the car is doing. They're all looking at their phones. Nobody's looking at anybody else. Everyone's got their head down, buried in their phone, and no one's really paying attention. Same thing on the platforms.
Yes. If I can just talk a little bit about situational awareness. When I teach this, I actually teach the most important, this is my most important thing that I touch, is exits. I want you to try to learn, pick up on exits. Wherever you go, know the exits. Every single restaurant you walk into, every single building that you're walking into the first time, where are the exits? And don't just go with the traditional exits, meaning the ones that have a red exit sign above it. What else would work? I used to play this game with Sandy, you know, Sandy, when we were dating, made me very popular with her. But the bottom line is walking to a restaurant, how would you escape? Now, let's say any particular McDonald's, you know, the door you walked into. How many other doors are there? Now, here's the other thing with McDonald's. Almost all of them are on street level, which means if you throw a chair through the window, you have another exit. And here's the other thing. Every kitchen has an exit. So if you jump over that counter, there's going to be an exit on the other side of the counter. Now, from now on, if anytime you walk into a place, you learn where the exits are, you're in a pretty good spot. Should there be an active shooter, you can start the run. Also, if there's a fire, it's always good to know exits. So a little situational awareness, every time you go into a building, where are exits? It will help you in any kind of fire or any kind of active shooter, which is your two biggest problems. You'll be way ahead of the game. And then you could start thinking about maybe limiting or really being more aware when you know you're in a place where the exits are few or hard to get to. And now you're putting yourself in a much better situation to survive these types of instances.
I hesitate to ask this, but what particular types of locations do you most worry about for this kind of attack?
So Roger doesn't worry about anything. But to answer your question, I don't think there's any type of location that you can't assume will not be a target. I think you have to, I think the less protected a target is, what we would refer to as a soft target, is what I think are the most dangerous. And those would be your schools and churches.
Yeah, right.
There was a time period where people would say to me, why are you, do you carry a gun all the time? Yeah. Do you carry a gun when you go to to a house of worship, to a church? Yeah. Why would you do that? Like, that's exactly why a coward goes to shoot people at a church, because he thinks they're the least defended to be to defend themselves.
Right.
So, quite frankly, there's no proof of this, but many of your movie theater shootings have been in movie theaters that said no firearms allowed. So, did the shooter consciously pick a place that he knew that there would be no other guns? I don't know, but I think it's worthy of a discussion, of a debate.
So, my last question, and again, thank you for doing this. My last question, it's not a political question, not intended to elicit a political statement. What's your general commentary on gun violence in America, which seems to be very much unique to America?
Well, it seems to be unique to America because America was formed and it was an issue in 1776 whether we could have a gun or not. So it's been from the forming of our country, the issue of whether an individual can have a gun or not starts that long ago. So I think it's broken down, without getting political, I think it's broken down to not necessarily liberal or conservative, although people will try to put it that way. But I think it breaks down more to rural or cities. Like, cities don't want to see a lot of guns, and people in rural areas, because it would take law enforcement 45 minutes or an hour to respond, they absolutely need their guns. So we to try to come up with one law that solves everybody is very difficult. I'm a huge believer in the Second Amendment, and I think that, but there has to be some sort of responsibility here. You have people that don't believe that anybody should have guns. I'm certainly not there. But you have to treat this mental illness. You can track, and I think you heard me say this in the television interview, when gun violence goes up, it doesn't necessarily mean active shooters go up or mass shootings go up. They're on their own scale. So you can actually have 2 or 3 years ago, gun violence went down, yet active shooters went up, or the victims of active shooters went up. I think it's tracked more to mental illness and suicide. Now, it's difficult to say that because the FBI actually keeps a number of how many of these active shooters had mental illnesses. But for you to have a, for them to say you had a mental illness, you had to be diagnosed for it.
Right.
So that's few, because the majority of people who do get diagnosed get help and they don't turn into an active shooter. So it's very difficult to say, oh, this is all mental illness, because the empirical evidence isn't there.
Right.
But I think when you see suicides go up, you could track active shooters. Very often they're going up. So yes, there's gun violence, but believe it or not, there's probably less gun violence than there was 20, 30 years ago. And people just have a tough time understanding that or believing that.
Well, it depends on how you characterize gun violence. There is mass shooting, senseless gun violence. There is person-on-person gun violence associated with some other crime. You're well acquainted with the Carnegie Deli murders, for example. You were a detective involved in the investigation of that. So there's all sorts of different types of gun
I
violence.
disagree. Gun violence is gun violence. So, and that's how the federal government tracks it, is if it was a gun involved, then it's gun violence. So whether it's a spouse killing another in a home, which law enforcement has very little responsibility over, right? Or to prevent that, or a mass shooter, it's still gun violence.
As a statistical matter, I'm going to push
Yes.
you on this a little bit. So there's, assailant on victim gun violence, and then there is of the type we've been discussing, which is that an active shooter is intent on just killing as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, whether it's 15, 20, 25, 5, and then probably take his own life. To me, that is a crime of a very unique and different character.
It is a crime of a definitely unique and different character, but it's going to take, so to your point, it's going to take unique thinking and unique strategies to address. And it's, you can't address it just by tracking gun crime.
Right. Roger, last question. Have you ever had the responsibility of consoling family member of a victim of gun violence?
So I have, but I don't separate. There's no difference of treating or consoling a victim of family of gun violence, or whether it was a knife or a baseball bat, or somebody drove over the person either by a mistake or an untimely death is an untimely death.
Yeah, not
And
a fair point. Fair point. Right.
a death by a perpetrator or a violent. By violence, there's no difference with the family or how you would approach it. It's not my forte. I never really enjoyed it. I never liked doing it. I would have to do it. And then of course, as a homicide investigator, not only did you have to be kind and considerate, but you had to keep your eyes wide open that you may be talking to someone that's involved.
What words do you try to convey to the mother, father, spouse, child of someone who's been murdered to try to ease the pain?
So I don't know that I can answer that question as a professional, but I can answer like my from experience. Like, all I do is I say I'm sorry. I try to be as concise with the information, and I try to have contacts for different type, like victim services. Perhaps even know what if we were really well informed. Perhaps we know whether the people are religious or not, and we already know where their house of worship is, and maybe we've even notified the house of worship that we need their help, or we're going over there. So if those things line up, the bottom line is you just be compassionate, you be honest and candid with the people, but also offer them services of other people who are much better at handling their depression and their sorrow, their grief. Than I am, because I need to move on and find out who the shooter was, and I got to try to get as much information as I can from him.
Well, in fact, you've been involved in long-running, multi-year homicide investigations where you've actually developed a bond with the victim's family, such that, the family member calls you like once a year to check in, right?
Yeah, you're talking about one particular case, and by the way, Frank Pillmar, he just passed away like in the last 3 months. But yes, he would call me all the time, just see how he was doing. And his son was killed by his wife and brother-in-law.
Fact, that is featured in a homicide series that you participated in. What was the name of it?
Homicide New York Netflix series one.
Right. I recommend it to anybody listening to this show. Roger Prino, thank you very much for your time and your wisdom and your experience. You are, in fact, one of my best friends, and I always value your judgment and appreciate listening to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Okay.